And hello, Sun's House listeners. This is Andy Bombeck, which means, once again, it's time for the Children's Story Hour. And as always, I'm glad you could join me today for a good variety of children's stories. Like always, the first half hour, I'll be reading picture books. And then the second half hour, I'm going to continue with a novel that I've been reading now for about 3 months. That also happens to be the 2024 Newbery Award-winning book given to the best children's book every year, titled The Eyes and the Impossible. But first, let's begin today's program with the picture book titles. I'm going to start off with a book titled Life is But a Dream. And then it's The Littlest Yak and The New Arrival. Bear and Fred, a World War II story. The Thing About Love. And if we have time, I'll finish up the first half hour with Lumberjack's Love Pancakes. So it should be a lot of fun. Let's get started with our first picture book today, titled Life is But a Dream. Okay, these are two gorillas looking at their little baby. On the night you were born, our world shined bright as the sun. We looked upon you, impossible you, and we felt everything. Who would you be? Who would we be? A great journey was beginning on this very bright night. Even still, we slept, and I dreamed. I dreamed of the many stars in your small eyes, of the music in your voice surrounding everything, everyone, everywhere. I dreamed of the tight grip of your fingers, the moment you'd go from small to not so small. I dreamed of you climbing high, higher, higher still. As we look on with joy, with fear, and with pride, pushed together like never before, so full I could burst. And on I dreamed. I dreamed you were away from us, exploring unknown places, and meeting someone new. Running, laughing, discovering like never before. I then dreamed of deep sadness, your heartbreak and sorrow, and I wished I could own it all myself. Still, I dreamed on, further and further, into your future, into ours. I saw a new you, taller, wiser, stronger, strong in body, strong in soul. And I dreamed that one day a great journey would end, just as another would begin. We looked upon you, impossible you. We felt everything. Then I awoke. Who will you be? Who will we be? And what will you dream? The Littlest Yak and the New Arrival. On the pointiest peak of a craggy clifftop, where the icicles swing and the snow doesn't stop, there's a mummy yak under a moon shining brightly with Gertie, the littlest yak, cuddled tightly. Oh, I've treasured the time that's been just you and me. But soon, Mummy whispered, our two becomes three. We're having a baby, gasped Gertie, brand new. Then I'll be a big sister Gertie soon, too. And she dreamed woolly dreams of sweet yaklings all night, till big sister planning began at first light. I'll paint a big banner with glittery pens that says, hello, yakling, I hope we'll be friends. And I've heard, Gertie frowned, that babies are sticky, so I'm knitting a bib, but hooves make it tricky. Well, in the swish of a tail, Mummy smiled, I'll be back. Home to the herd with our new baby yak. But in case you need hugging while I'm away, here's Granny Hilda. She's coming to stay. Then they waved a big wave as Mum left, slow but steady, and Gertie showed Gran she was big sister ready. Well, Gertie, Gran nodded, what brilliant preparing. But what yaklings need most is some big sister sharing. Sharing, frowned Gertie and stopped in her tracks. Then I'll be the best sharer of all sister yaks. Here's my curly wool comb for important back scratching, my pine cones for plain yak throwing and catching, and books full of pictures to help small thoughts grow, because yaklings have so much to learn and to know. Gertie thought, is there something I've missed? What else should I share on my big sister list? Then a worrying wobble stirred deep in her tummy. Oh no, Gertie gulped, will I have to share? Mummy! And oh, Gertie gasped, there's an even worst part. Will there be enough space for two yaks in her heart? Oh, there's space for a Gertie, smiled Gran, looking wise. No matter your bigness or smallness or size. But as soon as snores drifted from Granny Yak's head, on the tip of her hooves, Gertie slipped from her bed. And she drew Mummy's heart with her hoof in the snow, just to check there was space for a Gertie to go. Then she piled up the sharing things, all in a stack. But there's only room left, Gertie called, for one yak. How will my mummy fit both of us in? And her wobbly face wobbled from horn tips to chin. Oh, what do I do? Gertie whispered, heart sinking. This is the trickiest big sister thinking. I need some help to unworry my tummy. And my best of all fixer of wobbles is Mummy. Yes, I'll follow her tracks from our mountainside home. So big sister brave, she set off on her own, over the boulders with springs in her knees, then into the forest of shadow-filled trees. Till deeper and darker and farther she stumbled, a lost little yak as the snowy flakes tumbled. But wait, what was that? Something was racing. 100 yak hoofbeats were worriedly chasing, and leading the herd, with her hooves flying fast, was Mummy Yak grunting, oh, Gertie, at last! Mummy, cried Gertie, do you think there might be some space in your heart for a yakking and me? Oh, there's always a space, Mummy murmured, for you, and she hugged her the way only Mummy Yaks do. Then, hoof held in hoof, home they sped with a whoosh, till they stopped at the little snow heart with a swoosh. There, under the sparkling stars high above, Mummy knelt, and she rubbed out the edges of love. Then she drew it more hugely in powder puff snow. The thing about hearts, Mummy smiled, is they grow. And she took Gertie's hoof as they stepped in together. See, there's room in my heart for you now and forever. And look, Mummy pointed her hoof high above. A new yakking heart to add even more love. For tucked in a pouch across Mummy Yak's back, blinked the wooliest wisp of the miniest yak. "Oh, I think," Gertie whispered, "my heart has stretched too. It's grown a bit bigger to make space for you." And there, in the hug of the herd, cuddled tight, "our yakking," smiled Gertie, "is new, but all right." And though our herd's grown, and it's changed from before, I'm not loved any less, but a whole heartful more. Bear and Fred, a World War II story. Prologue. I am in a box all alone. It is dark, and I am cold. Suddenly, I hear voices calling out, "Be gentle, careful." And then the box opens. I hear rustling and murmurs. Above me, someone is removing layers and layers of wrapping paper. There's a burst of light. The golden sun sends its long rays to caress my fur. Now I feel nice and warm. The sun tickles my eyes. I open one eye and then the other. I'm surrounded by so many people. A kind woman gathers me up in her arms and hugs me. Teardrops trickle down her face. A large man stands off to the side and says, "I've been hauling that huge carton around in my truck for miles. And for what?" "Just a small and tattered teddy bear." First, everyone was so excited, and now they're all crying. What on earth is going on here? I don't understand what is going on either. The kind woman whispers to me, "Hello, Fred's bear. Welcome to Jerusalem. You are finally here." Many years ago, in a faraway land called Holland, in a city named Delft, I was Fred's teddy bear. I never had a name. Fred never gave me one. I lived in his bedroom with other toys. I was a happy bear. Little Fred loved me more than any other toy. He took me everywhere he went. We did everything together. And at night, when he snuggled under the blankets, I would sleep next to him on his pillow and dream alongside his dreams. One winter day, Fred and I took a walk. He held me in his gloved hand, and I peeked out at the streets we always visited. But the streets were almost empty. Very few people were outside, and everyone looked sad. Suddenly, I heard fierce barking. A big black dog ran toward us. He almost bit Fred's little hand. But at the last minute, he sank his teeth into me. I was scared. His teeth were long and sharp, and he wouldn't let me go. The dog whipped me around with a shake of his head and finally dropped me on the sidewalk. Little Fred picked me up, brushed off my fur, and whispered, "My poor bear, don't be sad. I still love you, even if your head wobbles." Time had passed. I sat on the windowsill. A cold wind was blowing. Brown leaves swirled in the air. Then it started to rain. Fred told me that meant it was autumn. Mama, Papa, Fred, and his brothers drank tea at the big table in the dining room. I heard sipping and the clink of teaspoons in their cups. No one spoke. Usually, there was lots of laughter around the table. Papa would play his music for us, but that afternoon, things were different. There was a soft knock on the door. I felt that something bad was about to happen. Papa's friend came in and warned us that in a few minutes, people would come and force us to leave our home. Then I heard a lot of noise, furniture moving, drawers opening, heels tapping, and voices talking. Mama said, "Children, We are leaving home, and I don't know when we will return. Put on your coats. We'll pretend that we're going out for a walk. I was scared that Fred would leave me in the house. I wasn't used to being alone. Fred always kept me close by. The door opened and then slammed shut. Silence. Fred had forgotten me. Then I heard the door open again. I felt Fred's small hand grab me. He patted me and whispered, "Bear, I won't leave you here all by yourself. You are my best friend." He put me into his knapsack and I let out a sigh of relief. Fred did not forget me. I sat in Fred's knapsack. The knapsack swung back and forth. It was dark inside. I listened to the footsteps as they became louder and faster. After that, I heard knocking. Someone opened their door. I knew this voice. It was one of Papa's friends from the orchestra. From inside the knapsack, I could hear everyone sitting down to eat. And then Mama said, "We must find a hiding place. We can't let them find us." Why did we have to hide? What did we do? When everyone had gone to bed, Fred took me out of the knapsack and held me close. He couldn't fall asleep. He tossed and turned, squashing me a little bit each time he rolled over. A long time passed until finally he hugged me tight and fell asleep. "Fred, we're going to Amsterdam," Mama said. Fred threw me up in the air and shouted, "We're going to Grandpa." Then Mama said, "Fred, only you will stay with Grandpa. It's too dangerous for all of us to hide there together." Fred stopped throwing me in the air. I saw how sad he looked. "Don't be sad. It will only be for a short time. Then we'll all be together again," said Mama. Fred and I loved Grandpa. He always played with us, and we had lots of fun together. I also liked walking down the busy streets of Amsterdam, and I remember going to a nearby park that had a lake with ducks. We took the train north, Mama, Fred, and I. Mama told Fred not to speak, but he whispered to me, "Don't worry." He sat me on his lap so I could look out the window. I watched the houses rush past. I looked at the bright blue sky with specks of clouds, gray and white, and many other bursts of color that all blended into one another. In the end, I fell asleep. I woke to the sound of a loud horn. We were there. Grandpa opened the door and rushed us inside. After a few minutes, Mama said, "Fred, I have to leave. I have to hide too. Right now, you have to take care of yourself. Never tell anyone where you are from or who you are. You must keep this secret. I promise I'll be back soon." I didn't understand. Why did Fred have to keep secrets about himself? Why couldn't he tell anyone who he was? Did he do something bad? Fred held me very tightly, clutching me between his hands. A tear rolled down his cheek and dampened my fur. "My Fred, don't be sad. Everything will work out in the end," whispered Mama. Then she added, "Is there anything I can do for you before I leave?" "Yes," said Fred. "I want you to fix Bear's head. It wobbles, and I'm afraid it will fall off." Mama cut out a piece of material from the inner pocket of Fred's gray coat and sewed me a new head. Then she connected it to my little body and used a red thread to embroider my eyes, nose, and mouth. I almost looked like a regular teddy bear again. Fred was happy. After Mama left, Fred and I stood in front of the large mirror. I saw my reflection, and it frightened me. My head was grayish brown, and my body was brown. I thought I looked strange. Fred put me down in the corner of the room and barely played with me after that. I was sad. Once, he even forgot me on the windowsill. I looked outside and saw the entire street covered in white. One morning, I woke up and saw Grandpa sewing a yellow star on Fred's gray coat. When we went out to play in the snow, Fred built a snowman with his friends and then put me on the snowman's head. Everyone laughed. As the children played, I noticed that almost all of them wore yellow stars, just like Fred's. One day, Mama showed up. She was angry at Grandpa. "Why did you sew a yellow star onto his clothes?" "It's dangerous." "It's more dangerous without the star," Grandpa answered. I looked at Grandpa and saw that he was worried. "We are leaving Grandpa's house," Mama said, and she ripped the yellow star off Fred's coat. Fred cried. "I want to stay here," he insisted. I did not want to leave either. I was afraid that Fred would forgive me, but he gathered up his hat and gloves, his notebook and colored pencils, and then he stuffed me into the knapsack, too. That made me very happy, even though it was crowded inside. It was dark and uncomfortable, but I was too scared to notice. Mama said that we were going somewhere else, but she didn't say where. My head was full of thoughts and questions. We walked for a long time. I pressed my ear against the knapsack and tried to listen to what was going on outside. I heard only footsteps. Suddenly, a door creaked open. Mama said, "Hello, we're a family from the south. Our house flooded after the dam nearby was blown up. My husband is very ill, and I have to look for a new home. Can my son stay here with you until we get settled?" I didn't understand why Mama made up that lie. "Oh, come in," answered a woman. I didn't recognize her voice. Fred pulled me out of the knapsack and sat me down on his lap. We didn't move for a long time. Mama and the woman spoke quietly in the corner of the room. Finally, Mama came over to Fred and said, "My boy, I am going now, and you're going to stay with this nice lady." "Mama, I don't want to stay alone. Why are you leaving me with strangers? I'm scared." "My Fred, it's hard for me to leave you, but I don't have a choice. I promise you that I will be back. And you are not alone. You have Bear." At that moment, I understood. I had to take care of Fred. Fred and I stood by the window and waved goodbye to Mama until her figure became a small dot and, finally, disappeared. From then on, Fred never left me. I usually sat in his pants pocket or the inner pocket of his coat. We never left the house. We hardly even peeked out at the street, though through the corner of the window. If I knew how to talk, I would have asked Fred to take me outside for a walk. I didn't like being closed up inside the house. One day, a boy came over. He looked close to Fred's age. They built a tower out of blocks and played with little tin soldiers. I heard them laughing. When the boy asked Fred, "Where are you from? Where are your parents? Why are you here all by yourself?" Fred remained silent. I knew that he was keeping the secret. Every night, Fred would whisper to me that he missed Papa, Mama, and his brothers. That it was sad being all alone. That the world was a scary place. And that he was lucky to have me, because I was his best friend. Fred whispered these things. As he spoke, he took my paw and stroked his face with it. Sometimes small hot tears rolled down Fred's cheeks, and I wiped them away. The winter passed. The gray clouds floated off to other places, and the trees all turned green. One day, I heard shouts of joy. The war is over. The war is over. Fred picked me up off the rug, hugged me, and whispered, "My bear, soon Mama and Papa will come and get us. Don't worry, they didn't forget us." One night, the door opened, and into the house stepped Mama and Papa. We were all so happy. Fred laughed and cried and hugged them so tightly. He gathered all his belongings and packed them in his knapsack. This time, he held on to me with one hand as we left. We traveled to a small village. There, we joined Fred's brothers. We became a family again. We took walks for hours and hours in the forest and in the fields. Fred picked leaves and flowers, and sometimes we'd climb a tree and sit on a branch way up high. I loved sitting there, listening to the birds sing, watching the sun play with the leaves, and looking out at the horizon. Fred would tell me stories about faraway lands, castles, and knights. He also told me that the world wasn't such a scary place anymore. Here's the epilogue. When the war ended, we left Holland and moved to America. Fred grew up. He got married and had two children of his own, but he never abandoned me. One day, a woman called Fred and said, "Hello, Fred. My name is Yelnut. I live in Israel and work at the Yad Vashem Museum. I heard about the story of your bear, and it really touched my heart. Would you agree to lend your bear to our museum in Jerusalem so that children could learn about your story?" Fred answered, "Bear and I have never been separated. We have always been together. But I will ask him." Fred held me in both of his hands and said, "Bear, we've been together for as long as I can remember. You are my very best friend. You watched over me in hard times. Are you willing to go?" I agreed. Okay, I'm going to finish up the first half hour of today's program with a picture book titled The Thing About Love. The thing about love is it can happen in an instant. You meet someone and boom, that's it. Your life is never the same. Maybe it's their smile, or the way they smell, or the funny things they say. You might not speak the same language, but somehow you understand each other. At first, it's fun just hanging around together, but over time, it gets even better. You play catch and hide and seek. You teach each other new tricks and dress up for special occasions. You share everything, take care of each other. You join a team and travel together side by side. You comfort each other during the sad times, lean on each other during the scary parts, and curl up together under your favorite blanket. Sometimes you get on each other's nerves. Sometimes you even get mad at each other. But the thing about best friends is you forgive each other. Growing up together is the best. Every birthday is the start of a new adventure. The thing about growing up together is not everyone gets older at the same pace. One of you gets older a lot faster. You start to notice they don't run as much. And hills are a struggle. Mostly, they just want to sleep. But that's okay, because the thing about friends is you accept each other. And you do the easy things together. You comfort each other during the sad times, lean on each other during the scary parts, and curl up together under your favorite blanket until even the easy things are hard and it's time to say goodbye. The thing about saying goodbye is it leaves a big hole in your heart and empty spaces everywhere. And the heartache lasts a long time. The thing about heartache is it can't happen without love. And love remembers. Slowly, very slowly, the memories start to fill in the hole a tiny bit. Because the thing about love is it never goes away. And the other thing about love, it can happen in an instant. And this is just a reminder. My name is Andy Bombeck, and I hope you're enjoying the Children's Story Hour. And as I mentioned at the beginning of today's program, for the second half hour, I'm going to continue reading the novel that I've been reading now for a little over 3 months. That also happens to be the 2024 Newbery Award-winning book given to the best children's book every year, titled The Eyes and the Impossible. Johannes is a free dog, a fast dog, such a fast dog. He lives in an urban park by the sea, and every day he runs through the park, seeing all, missing nothing, and reporting what he sees to the park's three ancient bison, the keepers of the equilibrium. But the equilibrium has been disrupted. Mysterious rectangles are hypnotizing Johannes. The humans are erecting a mysterious new building, and an entirely new kind of animal has arrived in the park. And there are hundreds of them. Johannes must run faster, see better, and ultimately do more than run and see. He must liberate those he loves. Okay, last week, Helen the goat is sharing a plan with Johannes to free the three bison. She said, to get them on a ship that takes the goats from the island to the mainland, where there are many goats and bison. The boat was loading the next morning. Now Johannes and Helen are talking to the rest of the goats, their plan to free the three bison onto a ship and off the island with them. And that's where I left off last week. Chapter 29. I had made a plan with Helen to talk to the goats once their day was done. It was just before sunset when I went to the windmill and found them all still eating, their heads down and jaws churning. Helen led me to a hill overlooking a field of flowers and weeds. Through the weeds, though the weeds were nearly gone, not one of the goats looked up. Just bark, Helen said. Bark, I asked. Do you know how to bark, she asked. Usually the dogs will bark. I had only barked a few times in my life, being the eyes required speed and stealth. And barking eliminated both, really. Barking brought attention to oneself and slowed one down considerably. You can't run so fast while barking. Not everyone knows that. But I understood her meaning. I needed to make some sound so the goats would take notice. And only a few of them had seen me ever, so I figured a very loud first impression might be in order. Yip, I said. Or I thought I said yip, but even Helen, who was standing next to me, didn't seem to hear it. The wind from the ocean was strong, so I thought my yip had gotten lost in the offshore breeze. I tried another yip, this one louder. This time, Helen took notice, but also smiled a pained sort of smile, as if to tell me my yip was more like a yip. I had to do much, much better. I decided to just go big and bark. So I sucked the wind from the ocean, and I ate the clouds from the sky, and I looked to the sun and gathered from her all the strength she had to give. And I roared a kind of bark that was also a howl, and also a bellow, and even a bit of a squall. I had my eyes closed as I unleashed it. And when it ended, I opened my eyes to find 1,000 goat heads and 2,000 goat eyes looking up at me, terrified. I had no idea what to say to them. But Helen did. "In the morning," she whispered to me. "In the morning," I roared. "We will engage in a heroic act," Helen whispered. "We will engage in a heroic act," I roared. Although I saw that these were the right words, the goats, who I took to be only interested in eating prickly leaves, seemed very interested in the words heroic act. We will cloak and free 3 animal captives," Helen whispered. "We will cloak and free 3 animal captives," I roared. I repeated her words for a bit, and soon enough, I had gained confidence and momentum enough to lay out the plan. The work of the goats was not so complicated, I should say. They merely had to surround the bison, leaping and baying and generally making chaos all around, so the humans minding them would have trouble seeing the bison in their midst. By the end of our gathering, I was convinced that the goats would perform their duties with passion and determination. The rest would be up to the gulls, the pelicans, the rats and raccoons, the squirrels and the horses, with absolutely nothing being done. Please and thank you by the ducks. Well, the only problem with any of this was that we had not yet found an opening to tell the bison about the soonness of their escape. All day the bison had been surrounded by those new humans in official seeming clothes with all their new tools. Every so often Yolanda would fly overhead to see if anything had changed, if the humans had left. And it wasn't until deep in the evening that she reported that the bison were again alone. "We heard," Freya said to me when I finally snuck into the enclosure. All 3 bison were in the corner farthest from the human-made parts of their world. "And we are ready." "We are so ready," Meredith added. The humans had spent the day measuring and weighing and poking the bison. "It was humiliating," Samuel said. "Degrading," Meredith said. "These were new people from a university of some kind," Freya said. I did not know what a university was, so I said nothing. But I saw that Freya was both depleted and very angry. I had never seen her so angry. "The usual parks people treat us kindly," she said. "We have known them for many years. In most cases, we have been here far longer than them. So there is a respect there, a respect for one's elders. But these new people, to them, we were just things. Rocks to turn over and inspect. Things to poke and prod," Samuel said. "So we are ready to go," Freya said again. I was thrilled to hear this, so we went over the plan, which both Freya and Meredith found reasonable and plausible. Samuel was not optimistic about its likelihood of success, but I had anticipated his dour outlook. As long as Freya and Meredith were for it, though, it would happen, and Samuel would go along. Freya had told me many times that Samuel would do anything to avoid being alone. "Now, Johannes," Freya said, her eyes suddenly intense and upon me, "when we're gone, I would like you to take over. I would like you to be the keeper of the equilibrium. Would you do that?" Well, I could not respond. There had been no build-up, no preamble, but Sonia had been right. "I know it's quite a bit of responsibility," she said, "but you are the clear choice. You have been essential to our work, and you've been privy to our deliberations and judgments. You are younger than we are, of course, but we have every faith in you. We really do, Meredith added. She smiled at me through watery eyes. You'll do well. Samuel said nothing, and finally Meredith turned to him, annoyed. Now would be the appropriate time for you to offer some encouragement. Well, he muttered, there really wasn't anyone else. I accepted. I would be the keeper. But when can we talk about all I need to know? I asked. There were so many thousands of things to ask, and there was nowhere near enough time. My son, Freya said, you have been the eyes for a long, long time. There is nothing left for you to know. And though I did not believe this, I accepted her verdict. I had no choice. Samuel gave her an imploring look, and Freya looked down, then at me. There is one more thing, she said. Yes, I said. You're half coyote, she said. Okay, sounds good, I said, because I had not heard her correctly. No, she said, her voice firm. Listen to me carefully. Your father was a coyote. I laughed because it was such a stupid thing for them to say. To say such a terrible thing at a time like this, when we had so much planning to do. I'm sorry, son, Freya said. Maybe we should have told you sooner. I told you we should have told him sooner, Samuel said. I couldn't speak. What Freya had said didn't make sense. Think about it, she said. Why do you think you're so fast? Why do you think the other dogs look at you like you're different, like you're similar, but radically apart? My throat dried. My eyes swam. Why do you suppose you make the unusual sounds you do? Do you know any other dogs who say, ha, ha, hoo? As you know, I had always thought all these things were due to me being a free dog, a fast dog, an extraordinary dog. This is what a coyote says, she said. This is the sound your father made. We love that sound. She looked to Samuel and Meredith, who both smiled. I could tell their minds had journeyed far into the past. Your father was the last coyote on this island, Samuel finally said. When he died, all that was left of his kind was you. Oh, how my mind spun. For a moment, I believed them. Then I did not believe them, no. They were old, and their minds were not sharp. This could be some sort of dream thought of theirs, some strange error of fading minds. He was quite majestic, Meredith said. I had no plans to ever tell you, Freya said, because it would not help you to know. It would only endanger you, really. It was better for you to think you were all dog. But now that the humans are looking for a coyote, you should know. They're looking for you, Samuel said. Chapter 30. I ran. By now the sky was dark and the sun's million siblings were out and shimmering. And I ran from the bison and to Bertrand. I had to see him, to tell him this news, to see if he thought it could be true. If he knew it to be true. Oh, I thought, I don't know if I could bear it if he knew too. I ran in the silver night, so angry, but then I remembered I had happy news too. I would be keeper of the equilibrium. I was furious that I had never known about my blood, my father, my origins. It had been so wrong of them not to tell me. So outrageously wrong. But the thought of becoming keeper shot bolts of happiness through me, and Bertrand would love this news. I knew. I pictured us together, partners, overseers, protectors. We would be unsurpassable. And as I ran to him, I realized he didn't even know that we were freeing the bison today. So much had already happened this day. I realized I hadn't seen him since he last flew over Helen and me yesterday. Before these many important revelations, before the ideas of mountains and ships and outrageous schemes of liberation, I ran to Bertrand's nest and found it empty, which was odd and unusual. I cannot remember the last time I'd found his nest empty at night. He was a very regular sleeper, fond of his routine. But if he was not at home, I knew he would be at the waterfall, his favorite place. But when I arrived, he was not there. I went to the row of garbage cans near the plaza. He sometimes got hungry just before bedtime, so I raced there, expecting him to be feasting on fries or buns. But when I got there, I found no Bertrand. I did find Sonia and Angus eating heartily from a bag of chips. "Gotta keep up our energy," Angus explained. "Of course," I said, and asked if either had seen Bertrand. And they said no, not since the afternoon. And though they were not particularly troubled by his absence, they agreed it would be good to locate him, if only to settle any last details for the liberation of the bison. So we split up to look for him. Angus said he'd look in the Cathedral of Flowers, where he'd known Bertrand to go occasionally, even at dusk, to take in the languid, lovely smell of night on leaves and petals. Sonia said she'd go toward the shore to see if any of the other gulls had seen or heard from Bertrand, and if not, she could get them to aid in and make quick words of our search. "I'm sorry I'm making a big deal out of this," I said, and they did not said not to worry, not to worry. Bertrand was needed, of course, and every moment was precious, given how close we were to beginning what I'd been thinking of as the Bison Freedom Gambit. So they rushed off, and I was happy they did not ask me where I would be looking, because I did not want to go and did not want them to think the same terrible thought that was crawling on spindly spider legs into my consciousness. When I arrived at the archery field, at first I saw nothing, not a soul, not a remnant of human or mammal or bird. The wind was gusting, and the paper targets on the hay bales were rippling. And I looked up at the sibling suns with gratitude for this empty archery field. But then I saw something white. It was on the ground, on the far end of the field. It was a small lump, a flash of something pale in the moonlight. Clothing, I thought. Some part of the humans' archery kits or clothes. I walked closer and saw gray, too. A gray half circle that I decided could simply be the shadow under the human clothing that was this shape. Finally, I drew closer and saw the yellow protuberance, a beak, his beak. It was Bertrand. I stopped. Why go closer? I wondered if I must get closer. Was it not enough to know he was gone? Why should I have to see him, his mangled body, the arrow piercing him, the fate he'd invited? And I was angry. I was so angry with him. There was no reason for this senseless death. There was no reason to leave this world like this, to leave me like this. Selfish, I thought, selfish, selfish, selfish. How would I live with this? How will all of us who loved you, Bertrand, live with this? Forever, we will see you on this field. We will think of your ignominious end. Why do this to us? Leave us with this. All for what? All for what? Chapter 31. But then he stirred. Then he thrashed. A whirl of wings spun, and flailed. I ran to him. "You're alive," I said. "Oh," he said, finding me above him. "There you are," he said. He looked away. "I'm so ashamed." The arrow had pierced his left wing. "I've been trying to break it off," he said, "to shorten it, to be able to walk. I've been here since the late afternoon." Now his eyes were wet. Again, he hid his face from me. "Oh, I'm so sorry. I'm so embarrassed. Oh, what stupidity." I wanted to agree that he should be embarrassed, and he was stupid, so profoundly stupid. But I am a practical animal and found myself focused on accomplishing the task at hand, breaking this arrow so he could right himself. "Hold still," I said, and he did. He obeyed me from then on, for which I was grateful. If I'd had to argue with him that night on the archery field, I would not have made it through. He held still, and I was about to jump on one end of the arrow when I heard the familiar sound of Angus sniffing through the grass. I waited, knowing that this would be far easier with his assistance. "You see any sign of him?" Angus said as he approached. He could not see Bertrand yet, but when he did, he rushed to us. "He's alive," he said to me. "You're alive," he said to Bertrand. "But what have you done?" "I'm sorry," Bertrand said again, and we began strategizing on how to break or even extract the arrow. And in the middle of our deliberations, Sonia appeared, saying nothing. We could hear the solemn horror in her shallow breaths. With the four of us on the task, we were able to first break the longer half of the arrow, the end containing the deadly silver point. Bertrand and I assumed that we would simply break the shorter end too, leaving a length still lodged in Bertrand's wing. But it was Sonia who thought we could do more. "Why not be rid of it?" she asked, and soon had her small jaws around the wooden arrow shaft and was pulling it away from Bertrand's wing. He grimaced and tears spilled from his eyes, but soon the arrow's bloody length came free and Sonia did what I wanted to do too. She ran with it in her mouth till she could hide it in a thicket where we would not have to see it ever again. "I'm so sorry," Bertrand said again. He looked at each one of us as if he planned to depart the world then and there from the shame of it all. "Stop that," Angus said. "You'll live." "You will," I said, and Bertrand closed his eyes, releasing new tears. We all knew he would never fly the same again. Chapter 32. We had no time to linger, no time to recount how Bertrand had been felled. We needed to begin the liberation. Bertrand would have no place in it, given his recklessness, his silliness, but we would deal with all that another time. We installed him in his nest, and we sutured his wound as well as we could. The others left, and I was leaving too, when Bertrand beckoned me to stay. "I'm so sorry, my friend," he said. "Don't be sorry," I said. "I was jealous," he said, "all that time you were spending with a goat. I guess I wanted to get your attention or impress you. None of it makes sense now. I'm so angry at my mind." I had known this, still can't believe this, that the mighty Bertrand would have been jealous of my time with Helen. Because time was short, I only said that it didn't matter, that he was my greatest friend, that he was a paragon of valor. "Valor, huh?" he said. "What I did was selfish and small. Just when every one of us is needed most, I'm out of commission. That's not valor." "We will manage," I said. "I'm so useless," he said. "You are not useless," I said. "I'm just a burden now," he said. I told him he was not a burden, not at all. And I left him in his nest, knowing he would live and heal, but be forever earthbound. I worried about him, that whatever dark clouds were plaguing his mind would only grow when he missed this most heroic mission of ours. Angus returned to the nest. His eyes were warm, sympathetic, but urgent too. "It's time," he said. "We have to begin." I nuzzled Bertrand for a moment and then ran. Chapter 33. Angus and his time machine were key to making all of this work, because the ship left at 7:08, and only he and Helen had any idea what all these number words meant. I knew just that we had to do it in the shortest amount of time in order to maximize the chaos and minimize any possibility that any of the humans could figure out just what was happening in time to stop it all from happening. This is what we were making happen. It started with reconnaissance. Sonia and I had to figure out how many humans were mining the bison that morning. Sometimes there were four, sometimes only one. It was up to us to assess just how many humans we had to handle. There was a light on at the bison enclosure office, so Sonia jumped up to the windowsill and peeked in. She counted one woman sitting at a desk, half asleep with her feet up. Then there was the hammock man who roamed the perimeter, and this morning we found him, where else, lying in his hammock, strung between two tall pines. We were thinking that this morning's humans were going to be particularly easy to handle when, no, we saw a large vehicle pull up, its lights like white blades slicing through the woods, and four humans emerge. And unfortunately, that's all the time that we have for today. I hope that everyone enjoyed today's program as much as I did. I'm going to say hi to all the listeners out there, and I want to encourage everyone to tune in next week when I continue with the fascinating novel titled The Eyes and the Impossible. Until then, I hope everyone has a great day and a fantastic week. So long and take care, everyone. Goodbye.